Hello and welcome to Helicopter Investor Town Hall. We're delighted to have four experts on helicopters and particularly on safety, which is the big theme this month. Delighted to start with Jason from Sikorsky. Jason's also brave enough to share slides, so I'm going to hand straight over to Jason, who's going to take us through his presentation, which was working a second ago.
Thanks, Alistair. So, thanks, Alistair, and hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you for inviting me to talk about the S-92 and the improvements that we've been working on at Sikorsky to maintain this important capability that the helicopter brings to its many customers around the world. In this presentation, I hope to show that we are incorporating some key technologies into the S-92 to further improve on the helicopter's reliability and safety record, which will in turn provide a strong foundation to maintain the value to owners and operators. Since the S-92 was certified in 2004, it has become to many different applications in executive and VIP roles, head of state, public, and search and rescue. S-92 sold very well and continues to be a strong competitor in these markets and provides a service that is essential to the applicants. But in addition to these applications, the S-92 is most successful in the oil and gas support role to at least 27 countries. We track on the order of 263 aircraft currently in service, and the fleet has exceeded 1.7 million flight hours. Prior to the downturn in the oil market, the S-92 fleet was flying around 14,000 hours per month. And while the average has slowed down a little bit to below 12,000, we are starting to see a modest uptrend in some recent months. The global distribution of S-92s is really key to maintaining this operating rate. The global distribution of S-92s is key to maintaining this operating rate, as helicopters are owned, operated, and contracted by a very diverse group of companies and governments. These companies all depend on the S-92 to provide reliable, safe, and affordable transportation for essential workers, heads of state, emergency response teams, and other support functions. All of these essential missions contribute to the continued need for the S-92 and will maintain the value of the helicopter for years to come. So just going back a little bit to the origins of the S-92, when the engineers at Sikorsky set out to design a helicopter, a new helicopter, we wanted to replicate all of the best features of its successful predecessor, the S-61 or Sea King. While the 92 was designed to replace the S-61, we were determined to take advantage of new rotorcraft technologies that would meet new levels of safety. The result was the first helicopter to be certified to Part 29 through Amendment 47, with no exceptions, which included the new crashworthiness and flaw-tolerant and damage-tolerant criteria. This groundbreaking design was recognized by the Collier Trophy, as well as the Harry T. Jensen Award. So in terms of safety, the proof really is in the results. And the S-92 has one of the best safety records for any multi-engine helicopter. Sikorsky helicopters in general have a safety record that's always been much better than general aviation. Both the S-76 and the S-92 have accident rates that are much less than the total helicopter fleet in the U.S., and S-92 accident rates are significantly better than corporate aviation worldwide and continue to approach those of the major commercial airlines. And that's always been our goal with the S-92, is to have a safety record that is as good as major commercial airlines. At Sikorsky, we follow a philosophy of continuous improvement for all of our aircraft. This chart, if you can see it, shows some of the improvements that we have or will be completing for the S-92. And most of these improvements are focused on, number one, safety, and then come reliability, operating cost reduction, and performance improvement. So this brings us to a product that we introduced bus is designed to provide an opportunity for owners and operators to upgrade existing aircraft with some of the latest certified technologies to further improve safety, reliability, and capability. The core of the A-plus upgrade is the new Phase 4 main gearbox and the gross weight expansion to 27,700 pounds with a new component lifing methodology that we call Life Plus. There are some additional options that owners can choose to add to tailor the upgrade to fit their needs, and I'll describe those in a little bit later in this presentation. But one of the drivers for the upgrades is some very important new regulations. Completed a significant rewrite of the regulations affected rotor drive systems. Sikorsky has been a participant on this working group, as have the other major helicopter OEMs. And this new regulation was released by EASA in CS-29 Amendment 5 in June of 2018. The FAA, by the way, will also be releasing a similar revision within the next 2 to 3 years. But this important revision affects both the definition of the system design and the test requirements in paragraph 0.927, which now requires the demonstration of loss of primary lubrication and then substantiation of the time required to land, which must be at least 36 minutes, demonstrated with margin. So at Sikorsky, we thought this new regulation update was a very significant improvement in safety. So in order to meet the new regulations and to incorporate some transmission design improvements we've developed over the last 20 years, we set out to design a new version of the S-92 main gearbox called the Phase 4. And we decided from the beginning that we didn't want to settle for a system that just met the 36-minute requirement, but we wanted to permit fly home capability, to be able to continue flying with the loss of primary lubrication until a safe landing was possible. The Phase 4 main gearbox auxiliary loop system allows the S-92 to fly up to its maximum endurance, which is almost 5 hours after loss of lube. And we have now fully demonstrated this capability in a ground test facility in Connecticut. We ran the new gearbox at normal operating powers and then simulated a rapid oil leak, which drained all of the primary oil, and then we continued to run on the auxiliary loop system. Every 30 minutes, we simulated a high power landing and then brought the test back down to normal cruise power. We actually ran this test for over 7 hours in order to demonstrate the margin required in the new regulation. And we experienced no degradation in performance and no significant damage to the drive system components. So this gearbox can essentially continue to operate on the aux system alone. So with this aux loop system, we've demonstrated a true fly home capability, and it eliminates the most likely land immediately scenario, which is loss of primary oil pressure. We think it's a true game changer for helicopters operating over large bodies of water in hostile environments, and it represents a new level of safety not available today. So I'll also mention that at the same time, this main gearbox incorporates many reliability improvements, such as an aluminum main housing, chip isolation between modules, improved lube pumps, dual chip detectors, an improved freewheel unit bearing, redundant scavenge paths, and shot peen superfinished gears. All of these improvements will lead to a higher TBO, and we think a good reduction in unscheduled removals, reducing direct operating costs. The second pillar of the A-plus is making the increased gross weight standard for all A-plus configured aircraft. The increased gross weight is certified today for the S-92, and very simply provides up to an additional 1,200 pounds of payload, which allows loading most delivered configurations with full fuel and passengers. When you compare the range with 19 passengers, GWE increases range by approximately 30%. So while GWE is available today, it also came with a reduction in some component retirement times. We are now working on a project called Life Plus to regain those retirement times. Life Plus is a new lifing methodology which uses 1.7 million flight hours of HUMS data to create a more accurate and representative usage spectrum and increase lives wherever the previous usage spectrum was too conservative. So the result of these two improvements will be one H92A Plus fleet with a common configuration of a Phase 4 main gearbox, 27,700-pound gross weight, with one set of component lives, all optimized via Life Plus. So in addition to the two main pillars, we also have a number of small improvements, which we will offer as optional equipment for operators that value them. The first is required navigational performance, or RNP. Required navigational performance, or RNP, is a capability becoming required by air traffic control regulations in certain regions around the world and provides a more accurate flight path, which helps improve safety and noise abatement. Sikorsky is implementing RNP in phases, with phase one being faster, steep approaches, and then phase two implementing additional RNP capabilities, including advanced RNP, which is capable of flying RF legs or curved segments during the terminal approach phase of flight, as well as RNP 0.3 capability outside of the approach or en route. The S92 has also has a new option for global real-time HUMS, where we are using the SATCOM on the L-band network to transmit a full stream of HUMS data real-time during flight. Previous systems operating on different networks had bandwidth limitations preventing full HUMS data streams. But with the Sikorsky system, we have demonstrated in both the Gulf of Mexico and in the North Sea to be able to transmit full data streams. I think it's kind of yet to be determined how useful this data is and how uniformly it will be adopted in the fleet eventually. But we have the system certified if the community agrees to the general benefit to having real-time HUMS. And finally, since we introduced rig approach several years ago, the system has been reasonably well received, but I think it's agreed by most operators that rig approach can provide a significant reduction in pilot workload during the high-stress phases of the oil and gas mission. Rig 2.0 is going to incorporate a new version of the LITEF AHARS, which will permit hands-off flight up to a quarter of a mile offset from the rig as compared to the current half-mile offset. We hope that this improvement will encourage more operators to deploy the system in the coming years and be standardized with the A-plus configuration. So that's Alistair gave me 12 to 13 minutes, so that's a quick update of what we have been doing to improve the 92. And we're confident that the Phase 4 main gearbox and other A-plus features will help to maintain the usefulness, the flight hours, and the future of the S-92 helicopter. So thanks very much for listening in, and look forward to more discussion and from hearing from my esteemed colleagues.
Brilliant. I'm going to bring Tom up as well now. We've got a couple of questions. Okay. Tom is Business Development Director at Sikorsky. Tom, how are you?
Good. Good morning. Hi. Good afternoon, Alistair.
Great. Got a great question from Mark Kelly at MK Consulting. How is Sikorsky approaching the future roles for the S-92 beyond oil and gas and search and rescue? For example, external loads and firefighting.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, no, those are the very markets we're looking at. Looking at firefighting, we have our Firehawk, which is a Black Hawk variant, and we also are looking with customers at applying the S-92 for firefighting missions. So, great question there. The other markets, which we've been in for a while, but there's been a real uptick of activity of late from customers, is the interest from the search and rescue community. You know, we've been successful in selling the aircraft, for example, to the Korean Coast Guard, and they've bought quite a few. And there are other Coast Guards and similar entities who are using the S-92 or want to use the S-92 for that application. And then, of course, VIP and VVIP, head of state. The S-92 is used rather extensively globally by head of state operators. And there's a huge uptick at this point, interest in the S-92. Primarily, we think, because of the head height that we've got in the cabin. You can walk in, most people, without bumping your head. Lavatory, showers, that sort of thing that can be incorporated into the aircraft.
Okay, and you've got a question about Richard Berkemeyer, Pegasus Aircraft Appraisal, is asking, what is the cost? He's asking for the new gearbox, but I think he's asking for the full retrofit as well.
Great question. So if you've got a retrofit, you've got a fielded aircraft, approximately $3 million gets you the kit for their gearbox and the gross weight expansion and the 19 additional passenger seats and gives you the complete package. Lightweight, meaning, you know, the main rotor fairing, a HISL, if high intensity strobe light, if you've got one. So that's a package that you get from Sikorsky. As far as availability, you know, we're going through certification, obligatory with FAA and EASA and others. That'll happen late 23 at this point. And we're building products so that we can begin to deliver at the end of 2023.
And Richard's asking, are you seeing the gear going on presidential fleets?
Yeah, so we think so. So we can't speak for the presidential, right? But certainly there's an interest. There's an interest by head of state that would include U.S. presidential to eventually take a look at this and see how it can apply to the aircraft.
And there's a final question from Antonio Martinez, head of leasing at Babcock. What about humanitarian disaster relief?
Yeah, perfect. So on and off, we've looked at that more on than off, but I'm just, you know, relative to what customers in that market space, when they ask for an aircraft, the 92 comes into play, as do some of the other heavy lift aircraft, the competitors. That is absolutely, you know, working with the United Nations and others, we would expect that the 92 is a perfect fit for humanitarian relief. There are a lot of optional equipment that could be applied to the aircraft and service that community very well.
Brilliant, Tom. Thanks so much. Thanks, Jason.
And my pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, we've just lost Tony Cramp, so I'm going to go straight to Tim Rolfe. Tim, with terrible timing, took over Heli Offshore in the midst of a pandemic. Have you regretted it, Tim?
In no way whatsoever, Alistair. Thank you. Now, in fact, I'm going to put a completely different spin on it. Yes, we've got some fierce economics going on in the background, and we've got the impact of COVID. But actually, from our perspective, from Heli Offshore and our members' perspective, we've had a really positive year. We've managed to continue operations serving the oil and gas community despite COVID. The rest of the world was in various states of lockdown, and the airline industry obviously significantly impacted. But offshore oil and gas operations have continued quite successfully around the world, being able to protect not only our own staff who are operating the aircraft and those in support of operations, but protecting the passengers traveling on them. And I think through a great deal of industry collaboration, very positive work from all stakeholders, including manufacturers, including regulators, including health authorities, we were able to come up with systems to bring people back from offshore should they show up there for their normal course of work, and they're either suspected or proven to have been a COVID case. So we were able to manage that. And that all came around in a very short space of time and was a really, really positive outcome of the collaboration that I think our industry sector has formed over the last few years.
So you went there from a large offshore operator. What have been your priorities in your, I suppose, first 7 months in the job, 8 months?
So we're always looking, of course, in a short, medium and a long-term sort of view. I think in the short term, we had to understand what the industry was doing around COVID and make sure that was managed appropriately. I've talked to that already. I think we're understanding also in the shorter term, do we really know and understand what the impact of COVID, whether it's remote working, whether it's reduction in manning levels or resources, the impact of the economics are having on the people on the front line. So we're trying to gauge that and understand where we need to target and focus our safety resource to support the frontline staff. In the medium term, HeliOffshore and its safety principles are driven on the data that we have, and we know what our medium-term targets are. We know that the principal causes of fatal accidents in our area are CFIT, control flight into terrain, loss of control, or single-point failure in mechanical systems. So with those being the three biggest contributors to accident, that's where we put our focus and energy, and we just make sure that we're continuing. HeliOffshore has a number of work streams working with partners represented here on the call today, but much wider, of course, as well, to target improvements in all of these areas. But we're also looking ahead to the long term, Alistair. So introduction of new technology, always want to make sure we're ahead of that, understanding that so that the people are going to operate it, have the right tools, right techniques and training to manage that new technology when it comes in. And right now, slightly earlier than we thought, the unmanned aircraft operations are starting to overlay what we're doing in the offshore environment. So we're getting a strong focus on that. We're working with Tony, I'm sure we'll talk about it, and Lee in their segments. We're working with other stakeholders to work out, okay, new technology is complementary. It's not going to replace what helicopters are doing. How do we safely work together as we move forward?
And you've been working lots on human hazards analysis.
Yes, indeed. One of the outputs from HeliOffshore, and hopefully we'll be able to publish another recommended practice in the coming weeks, is on human hazard analysis. So that's an approach which looks at initially the design of aircraft and the impact that design has on maintenance. And can we look at redesigning components, redesigning systems to ensure that the maintainer who's maintaining them isn't provoked into making errors. So this is it's not a novel approach, but having a standard around which to do this in industry is a new thing for us. We're really excited about it, because if we get this approach right, we can also apply this into cockpit design, we can apply this into pilot training, we can apply it into other areas as well. So it could be groundbreaking for us as an industry.
HeliOffshore launched, right? What year did HeliOffshore launch in?
So HeliOffshore started officially 2015. There was a precursor to HeliOffshore, what we call the Joint Operations Review, which was three operators in the UK coming together, realizing that the accident history over a bit, sort of 2009, 2014, deserved specific attention. So the Joint Operations Review had a look at what would be our key safety priorities in HeliOffshore, formed out of that officially starting 2015.
And that happened. And so it's sort of that, and just started at the top of the market, the push. And since then, we've seen the offshore, you know, the oil prices come down heavily. Operators have been have had a very hard time. You know, end users have had a very hard time. And it's stakeholders. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that in sort of, you know, the commitment that you have from your members, or the general commitment to what HeliOffshore is trying to achieve?
Yes and no. No, in that the commitment has been maintained throughout. You know, the stakeholders who are part of HeliOffshore remain strongly committed, and that's fantastic. And that's evidenced by the output, not just of HeliOffshore own products, but doing work with IOGP. I'm sure Tony would be talking about Report 690, which is setting a contracting standard for safety services across the industry. And then Lee, I'm sure, will be talking about work that's emerged ensuring safe operations in wind farm. So that's all going ahead. It's all going forward. For sure, one of the methodology that HeliOffshore uses to work is we rely on the sweat equity from members. You know, we're a small team. We're six people, and we rely on the input from a very dedicated group of people across the whole industry who contribute. But everybody's finding a way, and I think knowing what our priorities are and understanding why we're doing it, at the end of the day, this is about ensuring no lives are lost in offshore aviation. I think that's it's upheld by the commitment that we see continuously.
Great. We've got a couple of questions. Keith Willey from Rockwell Collins How widespread do you see the global uptake of TCAA-SIAII for medium and heavy helicopter offshore operations?
So I'm guessing that's TCAS-2, which is a form of collision avoidance systems. Certainly we can do more. We can have a higher level of uptake of that. The utopian solution would be that TCAS-2 would be the standard fit on all aircraft in our operations. And we're not there at the moment. We've got a mix of TCAS-1, which is still good, but TCAS-2 is definitely an improvement on that. In fact, of course, you know, fixed wing world, I think, are up at TCAS-3, and they're maybe even talking about 4 now, but we'll settle for 2.
Great, it was TCAS-2, misread, sorry. And Cameron Spencer at Flutter. Tim, are your members ready to start using electric or hybrid aerial mobility platforms?
So, really interesting part of the debate, because the whole remotely operated air systems thing ranges from, you know, small drones, which are typically used for inspection in very localized sort of areas. We can look ahead to the wonders of electric vertical takeoff. You know, we've all seen the images of what the future will hold for us. Interestingly, where we're seeing the introduction that overlaps with us is that the middle sector, which is long-range operated vehicles, relative size, predominantly being used for small freight transportation offshore. So it's not necessarily that our members are choosing to do that, although some are, but we are certainly very aware of other operators in our space who are working alongside us. So I think this is absolutely from a safety perspective, this is a conversation we need to have right now. Where's the forum that we're all very aware of what we're doing and how we're managing any safety issues that crop up through this sort of concurrent operation?
Great. Final question. Are you enjoying being CEO of Heli Offshore?
Loving it. Absolutely loving it. I've been in this industry for 30 years. It's a fantastic industry. I mean, looking at everybody who's on the call as participants, we know each other from times past, from times recent. It's a great industry to work in with some extremely knowledgeable, extremely dedicated people who are all running around the cause. We just want things to be safer. And our commitment to that goal will never let up.
Brilliant. And now I'm going to hand over to Lee, who's going to talk about some of the work he's been doing with Heli Offshore. Is there anything you'd want to add, Tim?
Only that it's been great working with Lee, and I'm sure he's going to tell you about stuff that's absolutely been happening. But, you know, we've traditionally talked about offshore oil and gas. We need to be talking about offshore energy now. And I see, you know, the use of helicopters by the operators in our space 10, 20 years ahead. We're just introducing and understanding, meeting a new set of customers in the renewable industry. So very happy that we're all working together.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Tim. And so now delighted to have Lee Harris, Senior Aviation Specialist from Siemens, on. Lee, how are you?
Yes, very well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Lee, do you want to explain what you do in your main role?
Sure.
So I moved into this role about 3 years ago after a career in offshore aviation, helicopter companies, as a pilot and other positions, serving and gas, and then a little bit renewable energy industry. So I moved over to Siemens Gamesa, who make the offshore turbines, install them and maintain them as an aviation specialist there, which of course can mean different things. But what it means for me is I write the sort of standards and requirements for our contracts and our operators, and we look at the safety assurance and approval of operators and operations, and that includes, as Tim mentioned, the introduction now of UAV operations. And of course, in other things that we do, we're looking at your traditional crew change flights, similar to oil and gas, while constructing the wind farms. And then we move on to a prolonged period where we are servicing our turbines, which of course involves a mix of crew change flights to platforms or vessels and hoisting to vessels and predominantly to the wind turbine nacelles themselves. So that's my day job. And then, of course, on the side, I took it upon myself to start the wind farm working group under Heli Offshore. Over the last couple of 3 years, we've been working on that, and proud to say we just published the first sort of global standards there, recommended practices for the industry. And that's been very well received and is now out there sort of being implemented, and we're getting feedback on it. So, that's me, I guess, in a nutshell.
Yeah, and it's a big document. I was flipping through it. Why is it important to standardize?
Yeah, I mean, when I moved into this industry, it was stark difference to me coming from a helicopter operator serving oil and gas customers. The lack of really standardization of the requirements, and it's a real hindrance to the deployment of helicopters. And that's damaging on all levels, safety reasons. It's damaging for the ability of the helicopter operators to exploit this potential industry, and it's not allowing this industry to get the benefit of helicopters. And it was very clear that we needed some kind of guidance similar to IOGP has with 590 and now 690. And there just needs to be some kind of standardization. We had issues. We contracted helicopters. We were challenged if we could even transport our customers' employees on the same helicopter and vice versa. Then you have the other challenges that, you know, a lot of our operations only need a part of a helicopter to service them. So only maybe 200 or 300 hours a year. So to make sense to then use one helicopter across multiple wind farms, and to do that, you really need some standard requirements and standardization. So that was really the impetus to sort of start this work.
And the few, it's a big report, but what are, you know, can you summarize some of the recommendations?
Yeah, and it could have been bigger. When we started it, the first thing we did was actually we sat in a room, and we got a list of topics that we all thought could be addressed. And believe me, it was a lot longer than is addressed in there. And we had to prioritize, you know, the top 10 or 15 items that we thought we could actually deliver. And we didn't shy away from the really difficult ones. So there's a bit of the report really that is a sort of education piece, because there are a lot of stakeholders in companies that contract helicopters that do not have the background that our customers in oil and gas do. So there's a bit of an education piece about how aviation really works. And then there's some of the tricky topics, such as crew composition, single pilot, dual pilot, about the helicopter performance for doing hoisting to wind turbines. And then there's some other items just about what's adequate experience, what level should we have for crew experience and training for the crew and the passengers, and who should deliver heliport facilities, because these sorts of things are also new compared to traditional oil and gas operations, where we're used to working from an established airfield. The wind farms are being built in new locations. So the airport isn't set up for helicopter operations, and a new base needs to be set up and delivered. You know, is it sensible for the helicopter operator to do that, or a third party, and why? So there's a little bit of talk about that and the regulations behind that.
And what surprised you when you were working on it?
In a good way, how willing everyone was to collaborate. It was a really good atmosphere, and you know, how everybody works together. Everybody involved in the industry could see the same requirement and had the same goal to get the same output at the end. But on the other hand, the sheer amount of work to start something like this and drive it from, you know, in the very beginning, get the work group together to get it to publication, that's a lot of work. And then also the diplomacy that's required for some of these really tricky sticking points. I mean, it's not surprising, because it's really challenging for some of the stakeholders. You have companies that are solely based on dual pilot or solely based on single pilot operations, and you have to cater for all of these stakeholders who are well established and performing well in the industry. So, you know, squaring that circle was sometimes challenging, but fun along the way.
Do you think helicopters have penetrated the offshore market as much as they should have done?
Absolutely not. And I think that, I sit here continually sort of almost frustrated daily in a way. I mean, it's a completely marine-based and marine-biased industry. There is no doubt. If I look at the ratio of aviation specialists to marine specialists, it must be in the region of 20 to 1 in this industry, at least. So I think there are a few key points that are not addressed by the industry. I think that it's a shame because I think the industry, the renewable energy industry, would benefit greatly from using helicopters. And I think that those points that would bring benefits need to be pushed, not by an individual manufacturer, but by the industry. You've got points such as our safety record is excellent if you compare that to transfer of people by vessels. You have, surprisingly, the CO2 output. Transferring people by helicopter is far more CO2 friendly than using vessels, even hybrid vessels. You have the speed of deployment. So these points and the access days that we have from a helicopter compared to a vessel in many areas of the world are far greater. But these points are really well defended by the marine industry and really not well promoted by the aviation industry. And I think that as an industry, we could do a lot better to unify behind that message, get some real data, and start to push that and question why are renewable companies not using the safest, the most environmentally friendly method to transfer people.
And can you see it changing?
It really varies, if I'm honest. I mean, there are really mixed drivers behind this. I see lots of reports. I see many reports, and it's great to have people doing this work, and it's great to see forecasts of 1,000 helicopters being used for offshore wind. I would say no. Potentially, the market could be enormous. I wouldn't say it would be this big, but it will only be a big market if these issues are addressed, if these points are pushed, and this point is won over the marine industry that's there. And we have to understand that we are dealing with stakeholders, unlike our traditional customers in oil and gas, that know helicopters. You're dealing with people that know vessels, so they need some real convincing to change from a vessel to try something new. It's a big business risk. So does it change or not? I mean, there are things that drive it further offshore. It drives towards helicopters. Bigger wind turbines mean that when they stop, there's a greater loss in revenue, and this is also amplified by zero subsidy wind farms, where every bit of electricity you generate, you can sell. So when the wind turbine stops, you want it working. That creates, you know, a drive to get people there quickly. But on the other hand, bigger turbines need bigger teams and bigger equipment. So it's more demanding for the helicopter to get there with the right equipment. So there's, you know, there's a sort of plus and minus to all of these arguments.
Okay, that's brilliant. Tom, do you have any thoughts on this?
I sure do. I've been tracking this business for a while now. I guess I got a question. You know, as we look at wind farms, and it looks like they're going further offshore for various reasons. But Lee, what do you see as far as the type of aircraft? Traditionally, we've been looking at small aircraft for closer to shore, offshore wind farms. But are you looking at medium or heavies that would be utilized?
We use mediums and heavies for the crew change already, but we are getting to the limits of the aircraft that we have at the moment. So traditionally, it was dominated by 135s. They are really being sort of phased out towards the 145, 169 size helicopter at the moment, because, as I said earlier, we're using one helicopter to service multiple wind farms. So it needs to carry more than one team, or it needs to go a greater distance. So we're seeing that with the future plans that we have with the wind farms, then certainly not heavies I don't see for hoisting, but for the super mediums, we see that there is a potential for that. But I think the real challenge is it's such a step change in the logistics setup. It's convincing the logistics departments to take that leap. in their business plan, you know, because right now everybody leans on a big vessel with daughter vessels to go and service these wind farms. And unless we can really convince them that there is a much better convincing business case for helicopters, nobody's going to make this jump for 5% gain, because it's a huge risk. If you plan a wind farm 20-year servicing life on a logistics concept that just isn't proven. So we really have to sell that story if we want to start to dominate the market with these super mediums.
Tim, how excited are you at the thought of growing into of the offshore wind market?
Yeah, reasonably excited, absolutely, Alistair, because I think, as Lee says, I think there's conversations to be had to understand what the new market opportunity is. It's difficult to predict when you're looking that 10, 20 years ahead and asking the question, what's the platform that we need? But the market itself is dynamic. It always has been and it always will be. But invariably, we know, you know, the utility of the helicopter, the ability to do something wherever it gets to, whenever it gets there, is its unique selling point. And we maybe haven't thought of all the possibilities yet. I take Lee's point that, you know, marine-dominated market presents a challenge, but actually as what was the traditional oil and gas customer base, as they transition into the renewable energy space as well, they do have that balance. They do understand, how do you apply marine? How do you apply aviation support technology? So I think there's learning, you know, as we all sit around the same table and learn from each other, see what the possibilities are.
And the report that Lee was talking about was a joint one between you and another organization. How was that?
In terms of collaboration, Lee led that wholly. So G Plus, which was is the organization that Lee represents, which is the equivalent industry body for renewables to IOGP for oil and gas, I guess. So it was important that I think Lee, correct me if I'm incorrect in this, but it was important that there was a sort of standard within their own industry, and then the wind farm recommended practices that Lee led all of the work on under the Heli Offshore banner was really around the focused very specifically on the helicopter operations. So there was a sort of lead in with the G Plus document, I think, and then the Heli Offshore was very specifically focused on operators.
Lee, do you think when you talk about the advantages and the safety, do you think there's a real advantage that you're building an industry with helicopters from the start?
Is there an advantage? I mean, we're not doing that really, though, because this industry is already massive. It's a huge industry already, with enormous investments in. We are commissioning vessels to be built from scratch, jack-ups to be built from scratch, largest cranes in the world to be built from scratch to service the turbines that aren't even made. So it's already a massive industry. So actually, we're not sort of starting it from scratch. We're really trying to break into it with helicopters, I would say. I think that, you know, there is there's a question with the sort of a scale of economy with a helicopter. If you have a helicopter added onto the logistics of a wind farm and you're only going to fly 50 hours off that helicopter and that's all you do with it all year, of course, each of those hours is relatively expensive. So we need to get to a point where we can use that helicopter for a reasonable amount of time, and then each, you know, operating hour is affordable for the customers. To do that, we need the helicopter to be integrated more fully into the logistics setup. And breaking into that is the real challenge.
Okay. Tom, do you have any thoughts to end on?
I think just on that point, Lee, I'm sure this will come up with operators. They look at this as complementary, I'm sure, to their offshore transportation services. And maybe the way the helicopter can be utilized more than the 250 or so hours per year is for them to be contracted, and they can jump from a offshore platform to a wind farm, assuming they're close to each other. I don't know.
Lee, is there a massive gap between offshore, the G standards and IOGP?
Say massive. I mean, there's a not a massive gap, because we're sort of borrowing a lot of it, but there is a gap, and there has to be a gap, because, as I say, we have to cater for an industry that is being already serviced by a real diverse group of stakeholders at the moment. So we do have operators that are heavily involved in industry that only will operate single pilot. So we have to cater for this. In terms of the other points, then not such a gap, no. And I would see that, this recommended practices that we've released now, they're not, the end, they're the beginning. These are a standard that we can all use and start to use and implement and get feedback from and react to the industry and develop them and grow them. So I imagine that they will close that gap over the years, only in reaction to what the industry requires.
Okay, brilliant. Unfortunately, Tony Cramp is having technical issues, but he will join us next month. And I think he's always got an interesting viewpoint on what's going on from the Shell perspective. So let's go to Tim. What takeaway would you like to give everyone? What's your closing remark?
My closing remark is to reflect what I think Tom and Lee both said there, that it's very easy to look at, new technology, the expansion into renewables as being a binary helicopters on versus off, whereas that's not the case. I think there's a really exciting future for helicopters in the offshore energy sector for 10, 20 years ahead.
Great. Jason, anything to add?
Oh, just I think that we need to continue the continuous improvement in reliability and safety of helicopters is the best thing we can do. Continue to work on environmental initiatives. Things like getting biofuel approved for helicopters to further reduce the environmental footprint. And then really focus on that, especially to get into new markets like the wind farm market. Yeah, focus on Lee's point about, comparing the performance of helicopters to the marine systems. So I think that there's a huge opportunity in the future, and we need to figure out the right way to make it the best business approach.
Lee, what's your takeaway?
Yeah, really echo a little bit of what's been said. I mean, we need to leverage the advantages of the helicopter. And of course, that hinges on us having a safe product. So we need to maintain our focus on keeping things safe through standards, through technology, and through continuous improvement. And I really like to see the industry as a whole get together behind the helicopter message and sell that and push that to the renewable energy industry to highlight the advantages of the helicopter.
Brilliant. And Tom, final remark from you?
I appreciate those remarks. I guess what relative to the wind farms, and Tim said it well, there's a lot that the helicopter do versus ships. I look at things like Sea State 6, which, helicopters like the S-92 and others in the industry are qualified. And it's kind of tough when you're bringing people and Leo will attest that and can share, I'm sure, bringing people to an offshore wind farm when you've got high sea states. That ship is rocking and you can't bring the personnel or the cargo to the site. You got to wait. Helicopter, you can bring that right in. And if you've got a wind farm that's down and people are looking forward to getting their homes re-energized with electricity, you want to get those wind farms up and running, and helicopters can do it. Anyway, listen, Alistair and everybody, for me, this has been a fantastic hour or so together and sharing. And I really appreciate, Alistair, what your company is doing. And I really would look forward to future town halls.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, thank you also to Sikorsky for very kindly sponsoring this one. Thanks so much to all of our speakers, Lee Harris, Tim Rolfe, Tom Rylajic, and Jason Durno. Next month, Tony Cramp will be here, and I think we'll also try for Clark McGinn next month. And it's an interesting market going on. Thanks so much to all our speakers, and stay safe and well, and we look forward to seeing you next month.